From California to Minnesota, Nebraska to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, China is a formidable economic and military competitor, but are they as strong as they appear? Dennis Unkovic, author of the new book, The Fragility of China, is here with the answer. It takes 270 electoral votes to win a presidential election. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story on who is ahead. Kamala Harris has copied Donald Trump's pledge to eliminate taxes on tips. And while that is good politics, it is bad tax policy. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why. And media bias in presidential elections is nothing new. But legacy news media, once known for solid journalism, are no longer hiding their bias. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. China is the biggest military and economic competitor with the United States, but the strength of their economy may be vastly overrated. Dennis Unkovic practices international law with the Pittsburgh law firm of Meyer Unkovic and Scott. He is author of the new book, The Fragility of China, Breaking Points of an Invincible Regime. He joins us now to discuss the Chinese threat. Dennis, welcome to American Radio Journal. Dennis, if you look back to the 1970s and particularly during the 1980s, the Soviet Union looked like it was a world power that was strong and was going to be there forever and compete with the United States. And then it all fell apart because the underpinnings were not strong. As we look at China, appears to be as formidable as the Soviet Union was back in that era. Do you see some fragility there?
Loman, the answer is yes. China had a great run between about 1985 or 1988 for the next three or so decades. It was growing between 8 to 12%. But that has really reversed. This year, it looks like China, the Chinese say their economy will grow at about 5%. Frankly, I don't think it'll reach the 5% because they're not only not having growth, but they're having deflationary pressures. But the difference between the Russians and the Chinese are the Russians have an economy that's really about the size of Italy today, while China's is number two in the world at about $17 or $18 trillion, and the U.S., as you know, is about $27 or $28. So China's much bigger and much more powerful, but it does face some problems, and that's one of the reasons I recently wrote my book.
Taking a look at some of those reasons, let's talk about the economy in China. They have spent a lot of money on a military buildup. They spend a lot of money subsidizing industries. Is all of this placing a lot of strain on their economy?
Yes. The biggest problem that China has today is their real estate market. About a third of China's economy is based upon real estate. And it is totally in the dumps. As a result of it, if you took a third of your economy and it's very poor, that puts pressure on the rest of the economy. Xi Jinping, the current head of China, who has been in since 2013, he's now beginning his third fifth-year term, has been very heavily focused on military. He has built up not just the naval capacities, they call it plan, in the South China Sea, but he's built up their nuclear capacities, he's built up their army, and I would say they're probably overspending significantly in the military area, which depresses the Chinese economy, and I think we're seeing the results of that now.
Taking a look at the demographics of China, they had a policy for many, many years, decades, of allowing just one child per family. Is that now starting to have an impact on their workforce and on their ability to really staff their economy going forward?
That's a great question. In my book, I have a chapter called China's Demographic Black Hole. And while we think it's China is a big and powerful country, they have about 1.3 to 1.4 billion people. But their economy is essentially, from the standpoint of labor, very, very seriously stressed. They had what was called the one-child policy. And you weren't only encouraged to have one child, but you were punished for having one child. But what happened is the Chinese people said, okay, this year, 2024, China's economy is growing at less than 2%. I'm talking about their population as to their economy. As a result, China is predicted to essentially have, in 50 years from now, instead of 1.3 or 1.4 billion people, they might have about 600 million people. The other thing is in China, demographically, in the U.S., as you know, a lot of us would retire at age 60 or 65 or 70. In China, people start to retire in their 50s. China has more older people, fewer young people because they're not enough at the replacement area. And this is a real demographic challenge. That's why I call it a black hole for the Chinese.
As you look at that and the fact that they have a declining population here, Dennis, they also have this military buildup, so they need conscripts into the military. Is this something that could ultimately impact their military preparedness as well?
Yes, they cannot continue to spend as much on their military going forward because the overall Chinese economy is very impacted. Let me give you one statistic. There's something called a debt-to-GDP ratio. In other words, what's your gross domestic product versus how much you borrowed? In the U.S., I really think it's too high. We're at like 130%. In other words, 130% debt versus our GDP in a year of $25 or $26 trillion. But the Chinese are at about 300%, or 2.5 or 3 times as big as the U.S. No economy, whether it's China or the United States, can continue to borrow money forever and not pay it back without having a major, you know, effect. That's one of the things that the Chinese leadership and Xi Jinping is facing now. And frankly, I don't think they've done a lot to really address it well.
The United States and China are mutually dependent upon each other, as we need pharmaceuticals and also the raw materials for electric vehicles, et cetera, from China. How likely is it that China would be willing to engage in any sort of an armed conflict with the United States, given that the fact that our economies are so tightly interwoven?
Good question. The Chinese are much more dependent upon the dollars coming from the United States into their economy than we are with the Chinese here. In the long run, the Chinese would make a big mistake if they, you're talking essentially, I think, about Taiwan, right? If they started to make a move against Taiwan and say, we really are going to invade them. I think that would totally crush the Chinese economy. So are they going to do it? I don't know. Xi Jinping doesn't call me every morning and ask for my opinion. But I do think that the pressures on them are just going to be immense.
In terms of U.S. policy toward China, would you say that we are at this point placing an overemphasis on the threat, or are we still not quite getting the threat that we face?
I don't think that most American industries recognize how dependent they are on China today. I'm a lawyer, and I work with some companies. I've advised them if they have a sole source coming out of China for something, a part, a material, or something else, get a second or third source. That is going to continue to be a problem, but even big companies, they're saying, look, I'm making a lot of money in China, 10% of my international sales are to China, but U.S. companies have got to be more sophisticated. And one of the things we're seeing, it's called offshoring or reshoring, but a lot of the American jobs, about 13 million that were essentially shipped over to China over the last 20 years, I see a number of companies saying, hey, maybe that's not so smart. Maybe I'm going to bring more of it back to the U.S. or have it in Mexico or have it in Canada, but not something that is so risky. If you send something from Shanghai to get to Long Beach Harbor, it takes 27 or 28 days. You get it from there over to Harrisburg or Pittsburgh or wherever you are in the United States, that's a 45 or 50-day supply chain that's working. That is really risky. We saw what happened during the COVID crisis. Where were a lot of our masks coming from? Where were the other pharmaceuticals coming from? You got it, China.
We have been talking with Dennis Unkovic. He is author of the new book, The Fragility of China, Breaking Points of an Invincible Regime. Dennis, the book's been out for a couple of weeks. Where can folks find it if they'd like to read it and learn more?
Thank you so much. The book, The Fragility of China, was published by Encounter Books in New York. It's available on Amazon. If you type in Dennis Unkovic or The Fragility of China, it'll pop up there. You can get it at bookstores around the United States. But my hope is that Americans will take a more serious look at China and make decisions accordingly.
Dennis Unkovic, author of The Fragility of China. Dennis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Loman.
It takes 270 electoral votes to win a presidential election. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story on who is ahead.
It's always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me back.
As we all know, hopefully everybody knows, electing a president is not a national election. It's a state-by-state election with the electoral votes rather than the popular vote being what really matters. So, Scott, let's start on the left coast in California and work our way across the country. What do you see happening in the swing states?
There's a lot of people in California. It's our biggest state in the country. But those 54 electoral votes are going to be locked in for Kamala Harris, her home state. Despite an exciting Republican Senate candidate, Steve Garvey, the former Major League Baseball player, running against so-called Shifty Schiff, that one's going to be in the blue column. But the neighboring state there, Nevada, has a real opportunity to flip red. Right now, the Real Clear Politics average has Nevada as a toss-up state. But when you dig into the details, take away the toss-up opportunities, Donald Trump is slightly winning in Nevada. They also have a really big Senate race. The Republican nominee is Sam Brown, a wounded warrior. Right now, he's looking like he might not pull it out. Then you go a little bit southeast of Nevada. Same thing with Arizona. Looking really good for Donald Trump to pick it up. But Carrie Lake is falling behind Ruben Gallego. So we need to make sure that Carrie Lake has all the resources necessary to win that race. We know how close she came when she ran for governor in 2022. Ultimately, the balance of the Senate could lie between Nevada and Arizona. We do feel great about the opportunity, obviously, of winning West Virginia now that Joe Manchin stepped aside. Farther up north from Arizona, in Montana, Tim Sheehy is going to defeat John Tester. That's not a swing state. That's a locked-in red state for Trump. The Democrats, for several cycles, have tried to target Texas, given the changing demographics and the 40 electoral votes that are down there. Nonetheless, Trump is going to bring home Texas. Ted Cruz is going to win comfortably there against Colin Allred. Barack Obama sort of changed the electoral map, especially during his reelection, and he won a lot of the Rust Belt, right? But then in 2016, Donald Trump focused on states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania. He really did a clean sweep there. But the problem right now is that, according to Real Clear Politics average, those toss-up states, Michigan and Wisconsin, today would go to Kamala Harris and the Democrats. And there's also two big Senate races in those states. Trump is just slightly behind in both those states. So then you go down to Ohio, a state that has performed very, very well for Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020, and they have 17 electoral votes. It's a big, big state in terms of population. And right now, Donald Trump would be cleaning up in Ohio. But we also have a big, big Senate race there where Bernie Moreno is facing incumbent Sherrod Brown. If we can do that and win West Virginia and flip that Montana seat, you know, obviously the Senate Republicans would reclaim the majority because there just aren't a lot of flip opportunities for the Senate Democrats. As we continue to make our way east, there's a couple of big states that you guys are going to recall from 2020 that Trump did not win, that ultimately resulted in him losing the presidency. One of those states was Georgia. Georgia has gone through ballot reforms and really election integrity reforms that improve our chances at making sure that there's honesty at the ballot box. Just farther south there in Florida, for a long time, Florida was the toss-up state in presidential races. But the thing there is you've got a great governor, Ron DeSantis, that is really invested in the Republican Party of Florida. And Florida is a solid Republican state now. It also happens to be the home state of Donald Trump. Then you go a little bit farther north in North Carolina. We've got a competitive governor's race. You've got several competitive House races. North Carolina has 16 electoral votes. I feel confident that Donald Trump is going to win North Carolina against Kamala Harris. Then when you get a little bit farther north, you got your state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and there are 19 electoral votes. So in totality, when you look at the Real Clear Politics average and the electoral map by eliminating toss-up states and actually awarding them red or blue if the election were today, right now, Real Clear Politics has Trump and Vance defeating Harris and Waltz 287 to 251. But you need 270 votes, electoral votes, to win the presidency. Pennsylvania and their 19 electoral votes, if that goes to Harris and Waltz, that gives them 270 votes based on the map today. So it really does come down to a few of those bellwether counties in Pennsylvania. It comes down to, once again, the rural areas, running up the score, building enthusiasm behind somebody that I think really represents the Rust Belt and the forgotten voter, the disconnected voter very well in Donald Trump, and with his running mate, J.D. Vance, and really the story that he brings from Appalachia and having success in the Marine Corps and being an author and a U.S. senator in his late 30s. It's going to be really exciting. Everybody kind of gets that, right? Especially if you're a political junkie and this is the kind of thing you're paying really, really close attention to. But the bottom line is the decisions that Washington, D.C. makes, from the Resolute Desk to the halls of Congress, really do impact our everyday lives. If you don't believe me, look at the economic situation through historic inflation for the past 4 years, exceeding 20%, and then also the illegal alien invasion that has ushered in more than 10 million illegal aliens to all corners of America, bringing along high crime and drugs and really threatening the safety of our communities.
Well, Pennsylvania is always interesting, both in 2016 and 2020. About 40,000 to 60,000 votes decided that state's electoral votes. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words about the club.
Well, today we kind of talked more about the political arm of the club, which is Club for Growth PAC. What we're trying to do there is elect free market economic conservatives that will make a difference in government. If you want to learn about the candidates that we've endorsed for the 2024 cycle, visit clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Eliminating taxes on tips has become a popular campaign promise, with Kamala Harris parroting Donald Trump's pledge. But there are some downsides to the plan, as we learn from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
No matter who wins this year's presidential election, tipped service workers might be getting a nice new tax break. But just because both major party presidential candidates are now embracing this idea doesn't mean it's a good one. I'll explain. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Vice President Kamala Harris has now followed in former President Donald Trump's footsteps by promising to eliminate income taxes on tips if she's elected. Trump, meanwhile, is already complaining that she's stolen the idea from him, even though I thought it was supposed to be something of a triumph when you convince an opposing campaign to adopt your views. Regardless, cutting taxes has already gained some minimal traction in Congress, too. Senator Ted Cruz and a bunch of House Republicans have drafted a bill that puts a few bones on the Trump and now Harris proposal and would create a 100% exemption for tipped income from income taxes. Unfortunately, this is something of a poorly thought out idea, no matter whose campaign or the fact that both campaigns are pushing it. When Trump floated this idea back in June, I wrote about it at Reason.com, and I covered the idea here on American Radio Journal, too, so some of this will probably sound familiar to you. The basics of why this exemption isn't a great idea remain pretty much the same. Eliminating taxes on tips while leaving the rest of the tax code alone would increase the deficit, it would create some weird economic incentives, and it would unfairly cut taxes for a small subset of workers while not doing very much at all to help the majority of Americans or to grow the economy, which is the real reason why you should cut taxes. Unsurprisingly, some in the media are now trying to argue that this was a bad idea when Trump proposed it, but it's a good idea now that Harris is doing the same. That's the argument that was made this week by the uber hacky Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik, who wrote this week, and I'm not making this up, he wrote that Harris's plan is, quote, much better policy. And the only argument that he makes to back up that claim is that it would include her proposal for a higher national minimum wage. But that is total nonsense, because tips are still going to exist even if you raise the minimum wage. I mean, just go to any state with a high minimum wage. Go to New York or hey, California, where Michael Hiltzik lives. If you don't believe me, there's still tips. And if anything, the tips in those places are higher because most people tip based on a percentage of the cost of a service, or like how much you pay for food. And services and food get more expensive when you hike the minimum wage. So this is a very silly argument, but it's also somewhat of a digression. If anything, given Harris's track record of talking about equity and fairness so much, her embrace of this idea actually looks worse than Trump's decision to throw it out there in the first place. Because there's no way around this. This would be a very unfair proposal for a lot of low-income workers. To understand why, we have to do a little bit of a thought experiment. Imagine two workers. One of them is a cashier at a grocery store, and the other is a waitress at a small cafe right next door to the grocery store. They both earn the same amount of income this year. Let's say it's $35,000. Under the current tax code, they would both owe about the same amount in taxes. A little more than $2,000 is what they would owe. And for the purposes of this thought experiment, let's leave aside any tax credits they might be able to claim and assume that they both pay the same amount. They owe $2,000 and they pay $2,000. That's fair. They earn the same amount. They pay the same amount. Okay, now let's pretend that tips are exempt from taxes. The cashier at the grocery store, she doesn't earn any tips, so she still earns $35,000, and she still owes that $2,000 in taxes. Oh, but the waitress next door, she earns $35,000, but about half of that total comes from tips. So you take that out, and now she's taxed significantly less, and she owes only about $600. I'm not making up these numbers either. This comes from an analysis done by Alex Mircianu. He's a senior policy analyst at the Tax Foundation. He's very smart. He knows his stuff. He knows these numbers. So the cashier still owes $2,000 in taxes, and the waitress, meanwhile, owes just $600. I think Harris ought to explain why she thinks it's fair to ask some low-income workers to pay tax bills that will be two or three times higher than other workers who earn the same amount in pretty much the same job. I mean, that's what she's proposing here. How is that fair? How is that equitable? More generally, I think this example is a nice reminder of why the government should pursue broad-based taxes with low rates and few special exemptions, and why the tax code should treat all income equally. Of course, it pains me on some level to have to knock down this idea because I'm a libertarian. I write for Reason Magazine. I want people to have less of their income consumed by federal taxes. And exempting tips would accomplish that. If you look at the most recently published IRS data from 2018, 6.1 million Americans reported tax money that they brought in from tips that was taxed, and they paid about $38 billion on that taxed income. So that's $38 billion that people would get to keep in their pockets. And I love that. You could even maybe convince me to overlook the fairness question. If some workers are benefiting, no one else is really being directly harmed, and the government is getting less revenue, that sounds great to me. But what I absolutely cannot sanction is a pair of unpopular politicians trying to boost their low ratings by promising special tax cuts after years of fiscal mismanagement have left the country with $35 trillion in debt and trillion-dollar deficits as far as the Congressional Budget Office's eyes can see. Trump added $8 trillion to the debt, and the Biden-Harris administration has added trillions more. There have been no indications from either campaign that either Trump or Harris has a serious plan for deficit reduction, and until they clean up the mess that they've helped to make, they shouldn't be allowed to promise more goodies to anyone. Both Trump and Harris should be asked the same questions about this plan. What will you cut to offset the estimated $38 billion drop in revenue that will occur if you end taxes on tips? And why should a small subset of workers get special treatment at the expense of everyone else, especially since adding to the deficit is a promise that future tax rates will have to go up? Until those questions get satisfactory answers, I'm chalking this up to being nothing more than campaign trail pandering. And remember that a bad idea doesn't get better just because it's bipartisan. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of this and everything else going on the campaign trail and around Washington, D.C. this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Media bias is always present, but this presidential election cycle, it is more blatant and pervasive. So says Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Media bias is nothing new, but media bias in the current presidential election has reached new lows. One of the starkest examples of it comes from a news organization I once respected, CBS News. I worked for CBS nearly 50 years ago, and I thought it represented the best of the journalism profession. The example I'm about to cite is so egregious that I think it's safe to say that CBS is now competing with NBC for the worst in journalism from a former mainstream media organization. So far, the election campaigns of both Republicans and Democrats are close to what my old friend Morton Blackwell likes to call content-free. Coverage by the legacy media, including CBS, has focused on words like joy, happy, and upbeat to distinguish the Harris-Walz campaign from the Trump-Vance campaign, which it likes to call dark, angry, and negative. None of those terms has anything to do with actual issues or policy proposals. Some have taken to calling this the vibes election, suggesting that vibes from each campaign are somehow more important than what the candidates actually propose to do if elected. Particularly in contrasting the vice presidential candidates, terms like encouraging are used to characterize Walz, while they love to repeat Walz's term for Vance, which is weird. They treat weird as if they had suddenly uncovered the key to his complex life story and personality. This cannot continue for the entire campaign, however. Soon they will have to cover actual positions and policies, and if the recent treatment of one relatively minor economic proposal is any indication, it won't be responsible coverage. As Molly Hemingway has written in The Federalist, the only policy plank we really know about in the glossy reintroduction of Kamala Harris is that she now supports one of Donald Trump's marquee policies. Last weekend, the incumbent vice president tried to pass off Trump's plan to eliminate taxes on tips as her own. Here's what Harris said. When I am president, we will eliminate taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers. The sudden campaign promise follows months of the presumptive presidential nominee avoiding interviews while flipping on nearly every issue on her platform, offering a case study in media bias, covering two identical positions from two very different candidates. When former President Trump declared his crusade to eliminate taxes on tips earlier this summer, the headline from CBS News read, "Trump proposal to exempt tips from taxes could cost $250 billion. But when Harris offered her endorsement for the effort, CBS reported, "Vice President Kamala Harris is rolling out a new policy position, saying she'll fight to end taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers." In other words, Trump is hell-bent on ginning up the federal deficit as a consequence of political patronage, while Harris is a determined fighter for the service worker. Newsweek even rebranded Trump's tax proposal as the Kamala Harris tax proposal. The Vance versus Walz coverage will continue to provide some of the best examples of media bias, both in terms of what is said and in what is not said. Here's Deborah Saunders in Newsmax. There will be no stories about leaked texts the now Democratic running mate sent to someone he once considered a friend. There will be no coverage and no outrage that she picked an extremist, a progressive, when she could have gone with a centrist. I'm watching CNN and hearing words like folksy for Walz. Well, as I said at the outset, media bias is nothing new in covering politics, but most of the time that bias is shown in disparate coverage of two candidates' policy proposals, a function of ideological bias. This year is bias in the disparate coverage of personalities. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMXO-FM in Olean, New York, WVMM-FM in Grantham, Pennsylvania, along with WJJB-FM in Gray, Maine. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.